All right, we're recording.
So, if we're going to use this for anything, you should introduce yourself.
Yeah, so I'm Jared Fawcett, and I'm the historian for the Minority Student Caucus for 2017 to 2018.
Great. And today is the 25th of January, 2018. Right.
Let me just pull up these questions. Mm-hmm. All right, so today we're kind of here to get a, I didn't even hit record on mine.
Okay. Yeah, I once went to a seminar I was supposed to record and I forgot to start. That was not good. Well, maybe it'd be good to close the door, too, in case we get some noise out there. That's great. That's fine.
Okay. Again, my name is Jared Fawcett. I'm the historian for the Minority Student Caucus for the year of 2017 to 2018. We're here January 25th around 2 p.m. With Vic.
Schoenbeck.
Yep. So we want to get an idea today about kind of the history of the Minority Student Caucus, the history of the Minority Health Conference, and Vic's experiences and Gillings throughout the years. I have a few questions and a few points to guide us throughout our conversation today, but please feel free to deviate from those questions or guiding points. So we'll start, I guess, in the beginning. Could you tell me about your time at Gillings as a student, kind of why you chose Gillings, kind of some of the social climate at the time when you were a student, and just some of your memories of your student life.
Okay, happy to do that, and I certainly appreciate your interest in me as I'm in phased retirement, phasing out. I had a kind of unusual path to the School of Public Health. I was not really sure what to do with my life. I remember thinking if I knew where I wanted to live, then I would go there, and if I knew whom I wanted to live with, then I would go and be with that person. If I knew what I wanted to do, then I would go and do that, wherever I had to be, and I didn't know any of those, so I was kind of searching. And I ended up traveling down towards the South. This was in 1971, and I was on my way to visit a young lady whom I had met when I was in England, and she was then in Waco, Texas. But I wasn't really decided that's what I was doing, so I was just kind of hitchhiking or taking a train or a bus or whatever on my way south, and I'd heard that Chapel Hill was a nice place, so I dropped in on somebody whom I'd met in England in Virginia, and she and her partner were driving down to Camp Lejeune, so I hitchhiked with them down to Camp Lejeune, and after spending a night at their place, I hitchhiked to Chapel Hill with a couple of Marines. And I got here, and it seemed like a very friendly place, so this young lady, the person who in Virginia who had given me a lift, her brother was a student at UNC, freshman, in Grimes' dorm, and so I waited on the steps, and when I kept asking people, are you so-and-so, are you so-and-so, and when somebody said yes, I said, oh, hi, you don't know me, but your sister mentioned you, and so, oh, great, how you doing, where are you staying? I said, well, actually, I don't have a place to stay, I wondered if I could stay on your floor. So he let me stay on his dorm room floor for a few days, a week or something like that, and I was looking around the campus, and I saw this thing in the Daily Tar Heel, I guess it was, about Health Ed 33, human sexuality class. And I was really interested in sex education in those days, so I thought maybe I'll go along and see what it looks like. So I went along to the class, which was in Rosenau Auditorium. It was taught by Dr. Tacky Crist, who was an OBGYN in the School of Medicine and been teaching this course for a couple of years, I think. And I was really impressed. I was quite excited about this. So I went up and spoke with him, and he said, oh, I'm glad you're interested, and by the way, I'm giving a talk at NC State later this week. You want to come? I said, yeah, I'd love to. So I rode with him to NC State, went to another one of his lectures. And so then after a few more days, I decided it was time to keep back on my journey. So I got back on the road and hitchhiked or took public transportation, went through Charlotte and Atlanta and Birmingham, Alabama, and ended up in New Orleans. And then from New Orleans, I went over to Waco, Texas. Tried to restart that relationship, and it didn't restart. So started coming back, and this was the place I decided I should come back to because it was the nicest place I'd, friendliest place I'd found. And came back here and moved back in on the floor, Grimes dorm, in Tom's room. And Jim Rumfelt was the other person, Tom Randolph and Jim Rumfelt. They were very kind to me. I decided I'd get an apartment and stay in the area, so I found an apartment in Carrboro. And then Christmas break came, I went up to New York, moved my stuff back. I'd found a way to transport Henry Landsberger. I don't know if name rings a bell, probably not. He was a professor in, I think it was sociology. And he was going off to England for a year and needed to get a car up to New York and then have it come back. So he drove his car up to New York and I met him there, and then I drove his car back to Chapel Hill for him, so I had my transportation. And in January 1972, I moved into an apartment in Carrboro. And, I wasn't doing anything about minority health. I was interested in the student movement. I'd been involved in the student movement when I was in London, the socialist kind of thing, the anti-war movement. This was the era that the Vietnam War was winding down, and I'd had my interactions with the draft board and so on. So I was somewhat radicalized. I guess the next thing was I found myself a part-time computer programming job on campus, and I'd hang around campus. I got to meet people and hear about things, and one evening I was waiting on line at a film to get into the student union to watch a film. And the way I would do that was I would kind of chat with somebody who was online and then see if I could go in with them as their companion. So I was talking with a young lady online. And then I saw this man standing there kind of looking at us, and she was looking at him, and what happened was he had gone to park their car. So I said, oh, excuse me. And they said, no, you're welcome to join us. So the man was Guy Stewart, who was the chair of the Department of Health, what used to be called Health Education, now Health Behavior. So we got to talking, and he said, and what are you interested in? And I told him I'm interested in sex education, probably on UNC campus. He said, well, we do field work as a large part of our degree program here, and the campus is going to be one of our field sites starting next year. So maybe you want to think about looking into our department. So I think it was a few days later, I called over there, and he wasn't available to talk with me, but he put me in touch with, or he referred me to Louis Nydorf, who was on the faculty that year, a couple of years, and Lou was... he had married a woman from Brooklyn, which is where I was from, so we had this connection. And he'd been involved supporting the student movement during the anti-war movement, so that we had that connection. And he said, well, you know, I'd be happy to talk with you about applying, but the applications are due 3 days from now. So I called up to Columbia University, where I'd been to undergraduate, and they had a service for references where they kept them on file for you, and so they sent my references, and they actually arrived within 3 days. So in those days they had public health traineeships, so I was able to get into the master's program and got a traineeship, and the next thing I knew I was a student in the School of Public Health. And that may have been longer than you were expecting to hear, but
no, great.
It's a story.
Oh, that's great. So can you talk, I guess, about, now that you've told us about how you kind of chose to attend Gillings, can you talk about your time as a student and your time, I guess, throughout the program and continuing?
Okay, well, so I was a student, and the first class was taught by Guy Stewart. This was Health Ed 130, Introduction to Health Education, probably. And he began by telling us his breakfast. which to the extent that I remember it was 3 eggs, 4 cups of coffee, and 5 cigarettes. And of course we all jolted, and he said, well, I'm telling you that to let you see that just knowing what is the right thing to do or healthy thing to do doesn't make it happen, that people's behavior is much more complex than that. And he made that point very effectively. So the class was an interesting one. There were about 20 students in the class, and I think half were African American, something very close to that. So I got to know a number of people, like Ethel Jean Jackson, who became a faculty member a number of years later, and Laverne Reed, who has been the professor and chair of health education and an associate dean, I think, at NC Central for many years. And Frankie Barnes, who went off to the CDC, and I have to pull my list out to see. They were really great people. And I gather that was quite unusual. I didn't realize that was unusual, but I think that was partly Lou Nydorf, maybe, being the head of the master's program. And also, in those days, they had traineeships. And Bill Small had been, I didn't realize it, but Bill Small, I guess, had been a recruiter there for a year, and his impact was being felt. So I really hadn't, I mean, I'd heard about the civil rights movement, obviously, and read about it, and but I hadn't been involved in any way. But interacting with these colleagues, and Ethel Jean Jackson, who'd grown up in Chapel Hill and told me a little bit about her background and what she lived through growing up in Chapel Hill during the era of segregation. And at a certain point, I realized that any person my age, any African-American my age who'd grown up in North Carolina had grown up in segregation. That wasn't really so obvious to me, and we didn't talk about it much, but that began to dawn on me. Anyway, I was a student, and in December I learned Transcendental Meditation. My brother came for a visit and told me I should learn TM, and thought, okay, I'll try it. And I didn't have anything particular that I noticed right away, but over time I began to notice I was less frustrated, and I felt more comfortable about some things. Gradually began to think, you know, this actually has quite a bit that it could offer public health. So that's something I'll come back to later, maybe, but that was when it started, but I didn't get particular. I mean, I was practicing regularly, and I went to some residential courses, but that wasn't much of what I was doing in the school. So I was mostly in sex education, or trying to do sex education. I'd go around to dormitories and lead discussions or give talks. We attempted to work on developing a handbook on sex education for the campus. I met with a committee that was put together by the Dean of Students, Fred Schrader, but that actually didn't end up going anywhere. I worked with the Human Sexuality Information and Counseling Service that was a student-created, student-led organization. The director was Robert Wilson, who's now, psychotherapist, psychologist in Chapel Hill. So I worked with that and did their outreach, and the outreach consisted of going out to dorms largely, but I gave some talks elsewhere. And I finished my courses, took a long time to finish my master's paper, and while I was doing that, I worked as a programmer again. When I enrolled in health education, one of the first courses I took was epidemiology, which I didn't know anything about. John Castle was the professor, and that was the most inspiring course that I'd taken, not just here, but probably in my university career. Bert Kaplan was the professor who taught the lab for that course, because in those days the labs were led by faculty. So I got to talking with him, and he said, you know, maybe you want to think about epidemiology for a doctoral degree. And I had some friends who decided to stay on in health education and get a doctoral degree, and they were having a long slog. It was really tedious and so on. And on one of my TM courses, I met a woman who was doing a PhD in epidemiology, and she seemed to be having a fine time. So I kept that in mind. And then I went on a TM teacher training course, I'll skip that for speed, but while I was on the course, I thought, you know, this TM, I think, is really good for public health, but the research, there's not much public health research about it. Maybe what I should do is get a PhD in epidemiology and do research on TM. So when I came back here, I talked to Bert Kaplan, and applied to the Department of Epidemiology, I actually said to Bert that I wasn't totally committed or sure, but if he were to learn TM, I would definitely go ahead. And he decided to learn TM. That's probably the only time in the history of UNC, or perhaps any university, that a prospective student has done that, but it's recorded. So anyway, so Bert was a wonderful man, and he helped me to get admitted to the department, and he had a traineeship that I was able to get. So I was in the Department of Epidemiology. I met Sherman James. He was on the faculty then. We'll hear more about him later, I guess. Between the time that I applied and the time I started, I became a TM teacher. I went off to Avoriaz, France, and took the second 3-month part of my TM teacher training course. So I came back, I was all enthusiastic about TM and teaching TM. And when we had our departmental orientation, Michelle Ibrahim, who was the chair of the department, was going to go around the room and have everybody say your name and your background, what you're interested in. And so I happened to be right up front. I was real enthusiastic. So I started off, I'm Vic Schoenbeck, and I'm from Carrboro, because that's where I was living. And of course, people laughed at that. And I've just come back from Avoriaz, France, where I took the TM teacher training course. And the room fell silent. And I could see the look of discomfort on Michelle Ibrahim's face, as he's thinking, what have we let into our department? Uh-oh, this could be a difficult year. So I was very relieved when this person sitting next to me got up and said, oh, I'm a physician, and I'm interested in cardiovascular disease. And you know, everybody kind of said, okay, well, maybe it's just this. It's not going to be a crazy year. So I realized I needed to demonstrate that I was okay to be there and I was a reasonable person. So anyway, I was able to do that, fortunately, and I liked to teach, and I turned out to be reasonably good at teaching basic epidemiology, so I became a teaching assistant for a couple of years and people liked that. And somehow they needed somebody to teach the introductory course, and they offered me an opportunity to be on the faculty. So that's how I got there.
Okay, yeah, and that's perfect. It's right and leading into the next segment. Just tell us about your time at Gillings as a professor, maybe some of the awards and recognitions, projects you've worked on, and then I guess going in towards your research focus.
Okay. I was very, very fortunate. I mean, serendipity has certainly been a part of my career. The opportunity to get into the health education department in the first place, and then to get into epidemiology, and then to get on the faculty in epidemiology. And in between there was a 9-month postdoc that I did with Bert Kaplan at the end of my PhD, because that was before I had the opportunity to get on the faculty. So I worked on something called health risk appraisal that was a project at the Health Services Research Center, now called the Shep Center. They had some funding and a project and needed somebody to work on it, so that's what gave me the opportunity to be on the faculty, and I began teaching introductory epidemiology to the epidemiology majors. And looking around for some research to do that and get some funding, and I worked on a project on social networks, where we used Evans County data to do a replication of the study that Lisa Berkman and Len Syme did on social networks and mortality. So I did that, working with Bert Kaplan and David Kleinbaum. And one of my major teaching assistant experiences had been working with David Kleinbaum, he and Larry Cooper and Hal Morgenstern taught an advanced epidemiologic methods course that debuted, I think, probably in 1977. And I took it, it was probably the second time it was offered in the spring of 1978. So I became a TA with that course the following year, and that was a major opportunity to learn advanced methods and become conversant with the latest thinking. And it also helped to establish my credentials, so to speak, in epidemiology to get on the faculty and afterwards. I kept looking around for some research and came up with, we had something going on through the Health Services Research Center that was kind of like a follow-on to the health risk appraisal work. But the big opportunity that came up after that was the National Cancer Institute came out with an RFA, request for applications, for grants related to smoking cessation. And since we'd done a little bit, that was related to that on this health risk appraisal study, and then the follow-on study that we did with an organization called Aid Association for Lutherans, we thought maybe we should try to go after that. I mean, the SHEP Center, I mean, the Health Services Research Center, they were a research organization that was oriented towards getting grants, and I was working with them, and Bill Beery and Edward Wagner. We thought, well, how can we do a research project on smoking cessation? We need a smoking cessation expert. So we, forget how we got in touch with her, but we connected with Tracy Orleans, who was a faculty member at Duke University then, who did smoking cessation and was quite a national expert on it. So we worked together and wrote a grant proposal, and it was funded, and so I had and I was the PI, because it was at UNC, and so she wasn't going to be the PI, so I was the PI, even though she was the smoking cessation expert. So that was an interesting experience. It was a significant data collection study. I'll save the details, but it ended up that Ed Wagner went to Group Health Cooperative of Puget Sound in Seattle, and we ended up doing the study with him at using the Group Health Cooperative enrollment as the population. So we were now, it was a transcontinental cross-country study, collaboration. This was the era when email was just coming along, and very few people had computers. In fact, when we started the project, none of us had a computer. But there was the School of Public Health had a VAX computer, a mini computer, and so you could do email with these terminals, the VT100 terminal. So I had a terminal in my office and could do email. So we did this project, and what I realized is that, A, I knew fairly little about data collection because I'd gotten my dissertation on the fast track, so to speak, doing secondary data analysis. And B, I didn't know anything about managing. And here I had over $1 million of a project, and we were hiring people and supervising them and all that, and I didn't really know much about that. So that was quite a learning curve with some friction along the way, and we had our issues. But on the whole, the study was successful, and Tracy Orleans developed a self-help smoking intervention, and we would go back and forth across the country to talk with people about it and make sure everything was going okay, and enrolled, I think, about 1,600 people into the study, if I remember correctly, and followed them for 18 months and produced several papers, and it was quite impressive. But after we'd gotten the grant and before we started work on it, the National Cancer Institute came out with another RFA. And this one was for smoking prevention and cessation among African Americans. So my colleagues, who were very much into getting grants, thought, well, you know, we just did this proposal, and it looks like it's going to come out very favorably. Why don't we do an adaptation for African Americans? We can get another grant. You know, and I thought, oh, yeah, great, sounds like a good idea. So we launched into this initially thinking we would just take this proposal and just, you know, tweak it a little bit. We needed a collaborator. We didn't have Group Health Cooperative. So I'm not sure if it was Cecil Sheps who made the introduction, but through either Gordon DeFries, I think it was through Gordon DeFries, but it may have been Cecil Sheps who made the introduction. He knew Charles Watts. And Dr. Watts was the medical director of North Carolina Mutual Life Insurance Company, headquartered in Durham, a major African-American life insurance company with branch offices in, I think at the time it was like 16 states, 18, or 30 states something. I can't remember anymore. Maybe it was 32 states. And so he thought that they might be interested in having a smoking cessation activity because they had done things that were for public health. You know, they were concerned about the community besides being doing life insurance. And so we met with Charles Watts and Charles Blackman, who was then, I can't remember if he was a vice president at the time, but he certainly became one soon afterwards, if not then. So we met and they said, yes, this sounds like something we'd be happy to work with. So we developed a proposal working with them for smoking cessation that would be a self-help intervention. But Tracy Orleans, and then later Victor Strecker, who worked with us also as a second smoking cessation expert, realized that it couldn't be the same kind of intervention that we were going to do with Group Health, which was totally print-based. It had some telephone counseling, but it was largely print-based. It was going to be written at a fairly high reading level. And Group Health Cooperative is an educated population. So now we're going to be working with North Carolina Mutual, which provides low premium insurance, low small insurance policies to African Americans, many of whom are fairly low income and not particularly highly educated. So Tracy came up with a new plan, which would have materials that would have tip sheets. So it wouldn't be just the print material, it wouldn't be just a print booklet, it would be these tip sheets you could put on your refrigerator. And also there would be telephone counselor. And also it would be a mediated intervention where a sales agent, because North Carolina Mutual had sales agents who knew many of the policyholders and interacted with them regularly, the sales agents would present the materials. By the way, I have videos from a training video from that project online now. Oh. If you want to see it, and I have the materials and all that.
Absolutely.
Yeah, I'll be happy to share them with you. So I had another big management project that was going on. Again, I was the PI. Tracy Orleans, in the meantime, had moved up to New Jersey, so we had this additional distance factor. It was a large group of people on the study. Including David Phoenix was a consultant, and there was another African-American consultant whose name I'm blocking on. And unfortunately, both of them passed away. But anyway, we did the study, and it had ample challenges. Maybe I won't go into them now, but if you're interested, I can certainly share more of them. We only got one actual publication out of it, but there's another article that I wrote, which I put on the web. As I worked on that study, it became clear to me. That's when I began to learn about minority health, because we went out to visit some of the sales offices, and I could see that the conditions were so different. I mean, for one thing, North Carolina Mutual is this major life insurance company, mm-hmm. but you know, in the white area, a major life insurance company would be huge, and money seen everywhere. And you go to North Carolina Mutual, and the building was a lot smaller. The officers would come down and eat in the cafeteria. It didn't breathe money everywhere. They had like a couple of photocopy machines. If you wanted to get something photocopied, you had to go through various things to do it. It was a big deal to get a printer in the office, a computer printer. I mean, so they were clearly much less moneyed than the organizations that I'd been exposed to in the white community. And I also began to learn more about, you know, so maybe smoking cessation isn't the number one issue for a lot of these people who are having trouble getting enough food on the table, or knowing that they would have a job going forward, or housing issues and safety and so on. So that began to open my eyes a little bit about minority health from the limited understanding I had. And when the American College of Epidemiology wanted to have a committee on minority affairs, I was a member of the American College of Epidemiology. I thought, well, you know, I'm getting like my income from this grant. I should put my name in if someone could be willing to do that. So I put my name in to be on the committee. And then I was asked if I could be the chair. And I said, this is kind of funny because I'm not the right person to chair a committee like that. But I talked to Sherman James, who had been on the faculty here. He was the first African-American faculty member of the School of Public Health. That's professorial rank, meaning like assistant professor. John Hatch was also a faculty member, was also instructor then. I think he was instructor, and that wasn't at the time considered faculty, but they essentially started about the same time. But so I asked Sherman, who was in the American College of Epidemiology, what he thought, and he said, no, you do it, because you'll do what we tell you to, and we won't have to take the time. So I said, okay, on that basis, I'll do it. So I chaired this committee, and we started up doing a survey of race ethnicity in the epidemiology training programs, because there wasn't any data available, and we thought, well, as good epidemiologists, we should start off with some data. So we did a mail survey with phone follow-up, and I just looked up some of the information, but maybe there were 30 programs that we got data from. Maybe it was 40. I can't remember now. But I can provide that. And we found out that it was around 6% of the students were African American, I think. And maybe 6% were Latinos. and faculty, maybe it was 3% and 3% or 2%, something like that. Very, very few relative to the population, obviously. So we worked on writing a report up, and we had some discussions about, so what should we do? And one of the people on the committee, I think it was John Wangu at Connecticut State University, suggested we should have a statement of principles, and we came up with a number of recommendations as well. So we put together these recommendations, and we drafted a statement of principles, and we got the College Board of Directors to endorse it. And then we went out and got endorsements from other epidemiology organizations, and the statement of principles was pretty good. Bill Jenkins, who was also on the committee, he's a very important figure in the history of the School of Public Health. Have to talk about him for sure. He did me the ultimate compliment by saying he wished he could have written it or drafted it. But it got a lot of help from a lot of people. We had the statement of principles. We got endorsements for it. We had a paper coming out about the survey. And then we wrote two other papers about minority recruitment activities and materials in schools of public health, in epidemiology training programs. And meanwhile, I got involved in some research. We did the smoke cessation research. I got involved in a sexually transmitted diseases study with Jim Thomas that he led on so-called core transmitters, core groups. And then I worked with Dorothy Brown in the Department of Maternal and Child Health on a study of adolescent sexuality, violence, and substance use in Durham called Project RAP for Reaching Adolescents, Parents, and Peers. And that was kind of the beginning of my, after a while, I mean, partly because I wasn't getting the kind of success with this study with African Americans that I hoped to. The NC Mutual study, and another study that I did where I didn't write up as much as I really should have. And partly because I had the feeling that, you know, these studies on African Americans should really be led by African Americans. And it was fine to work with African Americans and be helpful and try to contribute, but the thinking, the guidance should come from African Americans. So I was not really anxious about, while I really wanted to work on health, minority health, I didn't want to be leading it. So I teamed up with Dot Brown, and she led the study on reaching adolescents, parents, and peers. And then Adeora Adamora, who's a faculty member in the School of Medicine, who, as many other people around here I've had the great pleasure to work with, was one of my students once upon a time. I think she took my epidemiology introductory course in the 1980s. And in the meantime, then after a few years, she ended up on the faculty. So she wanted to submit a project on HIV in African Americans in North Carolina and asked if I would help work on it with her. So we worked on it together and wrote the proposal and very fortunately got it funded. So we now had a major study of, I thought it was major anyway, on heterosexually transmitted HIV in African Americans in North Carolina. And at about that time, Martina Morris came and gave a seminar here where she talked about concurrent sexual partnerships and sexual networks and how concurrency seems to be a significant factor in accelerating the dissemination of HIV in a population. So we decided we would use this study, we would make concurrent sexual partnerships one of the key research questions in our data collection for HIV transmission in African Americans. And we did that, and we found that in fact it was a significant factor, or at least it certainly had all the hallmarks of one. It wasn't a randomized trial, so we weren't trying to prove anything. And we then did several other studies that Ada, again, was the PI on, looking at concurrent sexual partnerships in African Americans nationally, using national survey data, and then in North Carolina. And we also, in fact, most recently, we did an intervention study that Ada led, working with people from journalism and mass communications, to develop a mass media intervention study to try to change attitudes among African Americans, among young African Americans, about young adults, about concurrent sexual partnerships. And that's just been published, I think. So that's pretty much been the major part of my research career, though Ada and I have published a couple of other papers, a number of other papers too, and it's been wonderful to work with her.
Okay, well, great. Thank you for that. So you talked a lot, I guess, throughout this about kind of leaving Gillings and coming back to Gillings and everything like that. So can you tell us, I guess, your total amount of time that you've spent here and kind of what, you know, ultimately led you back to wanting to be here?
So I haven't left for very long. I was here in 72, fall of 72 to spring of 73 when I finished my classes, and then I was connected because I was trying to finish my major paper and I was working at UNC. And then in fall 77 I came back as a student to do PhD in epidemiology, finished my doctoral coursework, and finished my dissertation in the fall of 79. Did a postdoc for about 9 months and then got on the faculty starting July 1980, and I've never left since. Okay. So I've had a wonderful career here. I've been so fortunate. It's a wonderful place. Met terrific people. It's just a remarkable place. You know, what I realized early on is if you want to have a really successful academic program, you get great students. And then they go out and do great things and you claim credit. And that's what I felt we've been able to do. But the colleagues are great too. I mean, it's really been a terrific place. And it's been a place that it's not only successful with the hallmarks of publications and grants and so on, but it has a social conscience. And it really is concerned about health disparities and social justice. And in fact, the school was founded with goals like that and genuine ambitions to make a difference for public health and social justice. And this department particularly has that history, the Department of Epidemiology, as does the Department of Health Education, Health Behavior. I mean, they were connecting with North Carolina Central, for example, back in the, I think it was the 1940s, as early as that, maybe even earlier. Teaching classes where students from NC Central would come here, even though this was a segregated campus, they'd pull the shades down sometimes so it wouldn't be seen, and then students from here would go over to Central and have classes with the students there. There's a book called Dreaming of a Time by Robert Korstad, a Duke historian. It's somewhere up there on my shelf. Definitely, but it's online too. Definitely worth reading. It's fascinating.
And I guess you started to talk about it a little bit, but can you tell us about your initial involvement with the Minority Student Caucus and the Minority Health Conference? Mm-hmm. Specifically, like, whose vision was it? I guess how it's changed over the years and how it started and what it's kind of turned into.
So, I mentioned when I first came here, I wasn't particularly tuned into minority health or conscious. And even when I went to do my PhD in epidemiology in 1977, I wasn't particularly, minority affairs weren't uppermost in my mind, and I really didn't, I don't know that I knew more than most people. But after I started doing research with minorities, African Americans doing minority health research, I became more aware, more knowledgeable, began to read more and talk to people, and then I guess something I didn't mention was that Barbara Hulka, who was chair of the department, came to me. The NCI had come out, National Cancer Institute had come out with an RFA for, what were they called? It was called Minority Enhancement or something like that. It was an opportunity for cancer centers to get additional funding to do more related to minorities in terms of cancer prevention and cancer control treatment and so on. And we had a cancer center that was interested in doing that, and Barbara Hulka thought I should write a grant for them to do minority cancer control here at UNC. And so we wrote this grant. We got a substantial award, much bigger than they had intended to give out, but I had talked to somebody up there who said, yeah, you could do it if it's a good proposal, and he defended it. So we got, I can't remember now, it might have been $250,000, which in those days was really big money. And we got a 5-year award to do 4 projects. One involved smoking cessation, a follow-up smoking cessation with NC Mutual, and Sandra Hedden was going to head that one. Another was to do mammography, mammographic screening for African-American women. And I think Jeannie Eng and Russ Harris were primarily involved with that one. And there was another one. There was a third one. I can't quite remember what it was on. And the fourth one was on prostate cancer. And Paul Godley, who was a doctoral student in epidemiology at the time, was the person who developed that one. And Paul also helped me write the significance section for the grant, which was a major help because he knew much more about this than I did, both cancer and minority health. So he had written, he really drafted it and did a great job. Paul now, you know, is a dean in the School of Medicine, associate dean, I guess. And I think the first African-American professor in the School of Medicine. And he happens to be married to Ada Adamor. So I've had a lot, I've gained a lot from working with that family. anyway, we had this, so in writing this proposal, I'm thinking, so what can we write? And it occurred to me, well, this minority health conference, which I had attended a few times, twice maybe, but not been involved with otherwise, is, you know, could be a part of this grant. And we could say, well, we're working with this conference, we will use it as a way of attracting minorities to public health and epidemiology and cancer control. And of course, by now, I'd been working with the American College of Epidemiology Committee on Minority Affairs, so the idea of doing things related to minority recruitment was on my mind. And so we wrote into the grant that we were going to be working with a minority health conference. Well, the grant got funded, but the minority health conference itself had actually lapsed for a couple of years. The grant proposal would have gone in 87, maybe, and the minority health conference, I think, didn't take place in 88 and 89. So I went to Bill Small. When we got the funding, I went to Bill Small, and I said, Bill Small was at that time assistant dean for student affairs, or students in the school. But he was hired in 1972, I think, as a minority recruiter for the school. And I'll tell you a little history of that in a minute, because that's really interesting. But anyway, I said, what are we going to do? Can you bring this back to life? So he rounded up some of the students. The caucus had been kind of dormant. He rounded up some of the students, and they got together, and they reinvigorated the caucus and the conference. And I threw in some money, and we had a two-day affair. One half of it would be on cancer control. And the audience filled the auditorium, which was, you know, as good attendance as they'd ever had, maybe better. And the next year we did the same, and it was bigger still, and they had to hook up some other rooms with video because it was too big to fit into the auditorium. And I forget whether it was the next year or the year after that, but there was, you know, of course there was no parking here, and people said, hey, we need a place to park and stuff. So that's when they moved to the Friday Center. And then it continued to get bigger there. In the early 1990s, mid-1990s, Dorothy Brown, Lloyd Edwards, and Trudy Bennett had written a grant proposal for a minority health project that was going to have a course on minority health research, because there really wasn't any, and to develop sources of literature and data on minority health. And so they'd created this. They'd gotten the award from the National Center for Health Statistics. They had started this course up. First they taught it in Michigan as a pilot, and then they taught it here. I think in 1995, I think, was the first year they taught it here. And then Lloyd Edwards, and then in 1997, they did the conference again. They did it in 96 and 97 as a workshop, as a course. But in the afternoons, they had a satellite broadcast of the afternoon sessions, because there was some money that someone had found and made it possible. And O.J. McGee traveled down with his mother-in-law's company to do the satellite broadcast. Have you met O.J. yet?
Mm-hmm.
Okay, good. You know, the following year, Lloyd Edwards got an offer at Duke University. Dot Brown, in the meantime, had gotten caught up in that reaching adolescents, parents, and peers, and didn't really have time for the project, the Minority Health Project. So Lloyd Edwards was running it, but he was now going to be going to Duke. So he asked me, before that, he asked me if I would become involved, because they wanted somebody from EPI. So I'd been working with it. But then in 98, he said, you know, actually, I'm leaving. So he asked me to take it over. And again, I said, well, you know, we should look around for somebody who would be more appropriate, but nobody seemed to be available. So I ended up taking over the Minority Health Project. And through that experience of the video, I thought, you know, this really extends the reach. Because whereas they had like 60, 70 people attending this course here, they had like 300 the first year they did the satellite broadcast. And it had gotten even bigger after that. So I thought, you know, the Minority Health Conference is maxing out the Friday Center. And this keynote could be heard everywhere. So we started doing webcasting of the keynote from the Minority Health Conference. And at first there was some concern by the conference organizers. Oh no, you know, people just watch the webcast. They won't come to the conference. But it was soon realized that no, actually that's not what's going to happen. So it was webcast. I think the first one was 98. I'm not quite sure. The 99, it was webcast for sure. And that was the first annual William T. Small Jr. keynote lecture, because that was the year that Bill Small retired. And then I think it was a year or two after that when they got some money from the state health director to do a satellite broadcast, because it was just a webcast for free in the 90s. But I think the first one, maybe 2000 or 2001, was actually a satellite broadcast. And the audience started to go up. We had like 2,000 people, I think it was, for one of those weeks, like 300 a day for 5 days. In the early 2000s. So now you had asked me several things about several things, and I've gone on a long time.
Continuing about the Minority Student Caucus, Minority Health Conference, kind of who started it.
Let me go back to that. So I wasn't involved in the starting it, but I have heard some of it, and the story has been told by John Hatch, and Bill Jenkins. John was here at the very beginning. John Hatch was a faculty member. He was a doctoral student and then a faculty member in health education and a Keenan professor by the time he retired. He's a real legend, among other things. He told me that the Minority Student Caucus was founded in his living room, or kitchen, I can't remember which, in 1971, at the end of 1971. By a group of minority students, I think they were all African American, and it was called the Black Student Caucus, at least for a period of time. I'm not sure what the first name was. There had been some attempt to increase the diversity in the school, and the first African American to get a PhD from UNC in the graduate school got it in health education in 1964. That was William Darity, who went on to become the first African-American trustee of the University of North Carolina at Chapel Hill. And Edward Ellis got the second African-American to get a PhD from the school, I think probably from the university, but no one can confirm that for me, because he got his 3 months after Bill Darity got his. So there were some African-Americans, but there weren't many. I mean, there were few, and the courses didn't really reflect the concerns of African-Americans much, and so on. So they formed a caucus in 1971. And they presented a list of demands to the dean. And he discussed them with them and agreed to a number of them. And one of them was to hire a minority recruiter for the school. And they helped to select Bill Small as the recruiter. Bill had been a master's student in environmental sciences and engineering and was working at the state. So Bill came back here and started working like a house of fire on minority recruitment, and was quite effective at it, really increased the numbers. And then it was in 1976, I guess, or perhaps early 77, that Bill Small, working with the caucus, decided that they should hold a conference on minority health issues as a way of bringing more attention to minority health and attracting more students of color to come to the school. So they had held the first conference in the end of March 1977. It was a two-day conference. Bill Jenkins wonderfully gave me a copy of the program from that first conference, which I have not been able to get for years, but he gave me a copy of it when he left town last summer, and I put it online. And they had big league people speaking at that conference, Bill Darity being one. Of course, Bill Darity wasn't as big league then as he became, but he was already pretty significant by then, because this was 77. He was dean of Well, I guess he was pretty big league. He was dean of the School of Public Health at Amherst, I think, by then, University of Massachusetts Amherst, but others as well. That was the first conference. I think it was quite small. It was held in a classroom. As Bill tells me once sometimes, they used to run out, they would run out in the hall to try to get people to come on into the conference, come on to the conference. Bill Jenkins had been here in the earlier 70s. He was president of the caucus in some year, I can't remember what. We need to go back and reconstruct the officers through the years. So the conference started every year from that point, except for that two-year lapse. It's gone on since 1977. And the caucuses, I mean, it's remarkable when you think about the fact that these are organizations that are led and staffed by students, with a fair amount of advising now from administration, though that wasn't always the case. Bill Small was a key person for many years, certainly. There's huge turnover. And a lot of them are master students who are here for a couple of years, maybe. And yet they've been able to keep this thing going and done incredible things. I mean, it varies a lot with who's doing it. In those days, people didn't have to have jobs. They often had traineeships or ways of being supported. Now, all the students are working a job as well as higher expectations than ever for their academic work. And they're also trying to do stuff on something like the caucus. How can you do anything? But the caucus has done a number of things over the years that have been quite impressive. We now have a substantial number of minority alumni in the school, and I've been working to try to help to enliven a network of minority student caucus alumni. So if we could build up that alumni network as an active body, even if people don't have a whole lot of time to put in individually, just to get that number of people putting in a little bit, I think we could really help the movement here in the school and nationally. So, the Minority Health Conference here was emulated at Michigan. A few years later, they started having an annual conference. UCLA started an annual conference. I'm not sure if it was emulating the one here or not. In about 2009, I guess it would have been, something like that, I was having a conversation with Howard Straker. Howard is a faculty member at George Washington University. He was a Minority Health Conference chair in the 1990s. And we were having a chat at a School of Public Health reunion. We got the idea we already have a webcast coming out of Chapel Hill. What if we had partner conferences at other universities that used the webcast from Chapel Hill to link them to the conference at Chapel Hill, but they could have their own conference at the same time and be part of a national minority health conference? So we put this idea out, and the first year I think we had 6 or 7 other student organizations, or maybe it was just 3 or 4, I can't remember in the very beginning, maybe it was only 3. I have them online, but the University of Illinois at Chicago was one, where one of the alumni from our school, who had been in the minority caucus when she was here, referred us, connected us with students there, and they started their own Minority Health in the Midwest Conference. That they had over 200 people their first year, and it's grown since then, and they've been doing it every year. The following year, George Washington University, Howard Straker got something initiated there. So there's been a partner conference at George Washington University many years. Tulane had a conference for several years. UCLA had a small gathering for a few years. Harvard had one for a few years. So, and then there have been others too. It looked as if this was going to be growing into a national minority health conference. And I'm hopeful that that will still happen. One of the major disagreements, I have generally tried to be a total supporter, but at times I think I have a disagreement or a different perspective. And probably the main one has been whether the partner conferences should be charged a fee or not. So I've had debates with the organizers of the Minority Health Conference and with other advisors and so on. Somebody got the idea that the partner conferences should be charged a fee to be a partner conference. And that has, I think, inhibited the number of partner conferences because it's made it look like this is something that we're doing to build our own activity whereas the original idea was this was a way that we could continue to build the national activity. Because when the Minority Health Conference was begun, it was begun to stimulate a movement, not to build up the caucus, but to be able to have an impact nationally. And I think the partner conferences and the webcast helped to do that, and the partner conferences, I think, can do that too. But the $100 fee, which is minimal, certainly, I don't think it can bring in enough money to be, make a difference, and I think it changes the feeling that other organizations get. So, but I'm hopeful that a way will be found. I mean, the best would be to get external funding to build out the Minority Health Conference as a national activity, and I think that's more possible when it's a national cooperative activity that different schools are working collaboratively to create, as opposed to something that Chapel Hill is leading that everybody else is kind of trying to go along with. So I talked a little bit about the creation of the caucus, and I have a recorded interview with John Hatch that's an audio interview and it needs some editing, but that's where he tells the story. And I definitely, if anybody knows audio editing, can help me with that. If not, when I retire in June, that's one of the things on my agenda to do, is to get that up on the web. And I have several recordings of Bill Jenkins describing the history of the Minority Health Conference, because he was here when the conference was started. Those are video, primarily.
Okay. Great. I think we'll stop there for today.
Okay, it's been a while, I think.
Yeah. So that was perfect. I mean, yeah. Thank you so much for coming.
Good, not at all. Thank you.
Let me label this.
Sorry, I was going so fast. It's kind of chilly in here, so I was getting a little chilly.
Oh, yeah, you're fine. No, you did a great job. Thank you. It was very informative.
So I don't know if you've had a chance to look at any of the stuff.
I'm sorry, I just...
finish your...
I want to make sure I save it. Okay.
Yeah, definitely.
Yeah, perfect. I think I got it.
You want to test it out?
That's great. That's fine.
Okay. Again, my name is Jared Fawcett.
Perfect.
Sounds good.
Yeah. Perfect. Yeah. I've looked over some of the stuff and everything, and then I guess we're really just trying to... It seems there's a lot of stuff, and we're really just trying to make sure that we have kind of a comprehensive way to just... you know, keep everything in order. So that's kind of what we're working on right now, is just making sure that we gather everything and then have like a cohesive kind of thing. So these conversations, especially where you tell us, you know, kind of everything that you're a part of, makes it kind of easier to like, okay, we can cross out off our list. That's something that we want to make sure we have documented. That's something that we want to make sure.
Well, where can we put stuff when you have it?
that's part of the bigger conversation. I'm working with Sam and everything like that and trying to figure that. Sam and Caitlin trying to figure that out now. So we're trying to figure out a way. I guess they've been part of these other meetings and everything like that.
They haven't been, yeah.
Yeah, so I don't really know. But
one thing I wondered about, I mean, there are people who know about this sort of thing professionally. Mm-hmm. And there are also students who work on these kind of things professionally, or at least they're learning to. And I wonder if connecting with somebody, in fact, this morning when I was coming in, I met a young student, a master's student in the School of Media and Journalism, I guess it's called now, who also has an interest in history. So somebody like him conceivably could help advise us on how to do this.
That's a great idea.
And it's conceivable, you know, I don't know about raising money, but it's conceivable we could raise some money. You know, we've got all these alumni out there, and a lot of them are emotionally invested in this history, and, you know, most of them have jobs. So it might be possible to get to collect some money, you know, maybe a few $1,000s or something, to hire a student or somebody else to expand the amount of time that can be put into it and bring in the expertise. So, I mean, one thing that's easy is putting things on the web.
Yeah.
And with the Internet Archive, it's possible to archive a website so that it doesn't get lost, even if the school decides to change some aspect of its activity, which, you know, the school's website gets redesigned periodically. And it's unfortunately, things sometimes just disappear because if there's nobody equipped to
right.
redo it, then it just goes away. And so that is something to be always aware of with things on the web. And the thing with physical stuff is that, you know, there's been stuff in the school that's disappeared because maybe it's being stored in this office. The Minority Student Caucus has an office mm-hmm. or Student Affairs office. But then, well, you know, we're renovating Rosenau. All the stuff has to be moved, whatever it is. And I don't know where a whole lot of the stuff has gone that Bill Small had, for example. There might need to be some kind of an arrangement with something like the Southern Historical Collection. And I have the names of some people there who might
okay.
be interested. The library is another possibility. There's the North Carolina collection. I mean, you know, there are discussions that need to happen. And having somebody who was knowledgeable and maybe could devote some time to it more than just what you can squeeze out from the course, you know, in between your courses and papers and things,
right.
Might be
that's
a strategy.
Okay, that's a great idea. I mean, I've never heard them say anything like that. And anything, so I will definitely bring that to their attention, and then, you know, we'll just get everybody on the same
okay.
page.
Well, I mean, I have to do this for myself, because I've got a lot of stuff in here that's not Minority Health.
Yeah.
That I need to figure out, too.
Okay.
But,
Perfect. Well, thank you so much for this.
Thank you.
I mean, it was,
I'm honored.
You know, very interesting to kind of learn about this
stuff.
So. All right.